Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 10th of March. Judith Warner is our guest this hour of the program. Her latest book is We've Got Issues, Children and Parents in the Age of Medication. Judith is also the author of Perfect Madness, Motherhood in the Age of Anxiety, and Hillary Clinton, The Inside Story. She writes the Domestic Disturbances column for the New York Times and is a former special correspondent for Newsweek in Paris. How this book came to be is a very interesting story, which we'll hear from Judith, but she talks about the suffering of children, she says, with mental issues and their parents is very real. No parent takes the issue of psychiatric diagnosis lightly or rushes to drug his or her child, and responsible child psychiatrists don't either. Many children's lives are essentially saved by medication, particularly when it's combined with evidence-based forms of therapy. It doesn't mean that she accepts absolutely everything that's done today by child psychiatrists. There is much to excoriate about the current state of psychiatric care in our country, she writes. And the outsized, insufficiently regulated, sometimes criminal, irresponsible role of the pharmaceutical industry. She had a different point of view about all of this before she started to write this book, which took took quite a while. It's just been published, and then she started writing it several years ago. So it's about her trying to find the truth and challenge the ideas that she had. Before she was writing this, she had no reason really to challenge the ideas that she had, and this book really challenged her. So that's quite a story as well. I have a feeling we're going to get tons of phone calls on this issue, so we'll take your phone calls in just a little while. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and our email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Hello, Judith. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
Why don't you start, because I found this story fascinating, in February of 2004 when you first started this book, and your thoughts about this, and they were not as a result of not having information. There were a lot of newspaper articles. There was a lot of concern in the country about the number of children who were being diagnosed with disorders. But you started this book at a different mindset than you did several years later.
That's right. I started out writing a book on overdiagnosis and overmedication, on how America's kids were being diagnosed with all sorts of new, largely made-up seeming diagnoses, that they were being pathologized by parents and teachers and schools and doctors when they had nothing really very wrong with them other than just being normal kids living in abnormal times, and that parents were being lazy and taking the easy way out, not looking at the problems in their lives or the, you know, substantial problems with the way they were parenting, let's say, and instead just looking for quick fix solutions in the form of pills. This was a point of view that it was very easy to have because it was, and frankly still is, the mainstream viewpoint on what's going on with children's mental health diagnoses and treatment.
And then you started hearing from some parents who had absolutely devastating stories to tell, and behavior that we just didn't hear very much about, that was obviously something very wrong was going on with a number of these children.
Well, you know, there were signs very early on that there was something very wrong with this idea. A friend of mine in New York has a son, very serious problems. I mean, started talking about suicide when he was six, started hearing things, was unable to remain in a mainstream school, had to switch to a variety of therapeutic schools, including eventually a therapeutic boarding school. Had to be on really, really heavy-duty medication in order to be able to live at home at all, has to have two shadows, men who come to the house to help kind of keep the peace in the afternoons when he's home after school, you know, really, really serious problems. Mm-hmm. And when I shared the original idea of the book with this friend, she's not somebody who's confrontational, so she didn't say to me, you have no idea what you're talking about. She just looked at me very calmly as I talked to her about the social construction of disease and how children's problems were metaphors for our age and how medications didn't work. They were just, you know, being pushed by the drug companies and prescribed by doctors who took money from drug companies. And she said to me, how do you know that?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that question, I sort of bristled at the time. I mean, how could I be asked that? You know, we read this everywhere. Everybody knew mm-hmm. this. The story was everywhere. But the question haunted me. You know, how did I know that exactly? I went to a parent meeting early on. Parents in the area, it was called Should I Worry? Was the way the meeting was billed. And it was supposed to be for parents who were anxious about some of their children's symptoms and wondering whether there was really something wrong or if it was just normal childhood stuff. And I went to this thinking it would be, you know, sort of pushy Washington area parents wondering why their kids were getting B's instead of A's. And instead, I found myself in a room with people who had just faced terrible things, children who had actually been violent with them where they had had to call 911, or who routinely destroyed the house with their rages, who couldn't function in mainstream schools, but who were up against the school system that just seemed dead set and throwing up roadblocks to getting proper care. And they were trying to figure out together, how do you navigate this system? How do you get kids the care that they really need and make sure they're getting kind of specialized attention that they need? And, you know, I left this meeting and I just cried driving on the way home because I had never experienced that kind of pain in a room before. I had done all kinds of interviews for Perfect Madness, the book that you mentioned, where I'd interviewed women talking about very personal things in their lives. But they would laugh. They were drinking wine. It wasn't like this. But the next morning, I looked at the notebook with my notes from that evening, and I just wrote across the top of it, this is not what I'm writing about. You know, at those early years, I was going to make that first idea work no matter what.
Right.
But it was harder and harder and harder.
Right, because you were listening, because you saw something. You saw something.
And because doctors were telling me I was wrong. Even mm-hmm. doctors who I interviewed, who I'd put on a source list because I had seen them quoted already in the media saying things that I thought backed up my argument, they just told me I was wrong.
Is part of the problem here, Judith, you talk about the fact that obviously there were bipolar kids back in the 50s and 60s. There were kids who had ADHD. We just didn't have diagnoses of this that long ago. But some of us are thinking, well, we grew up in that time. You know, nobody had these kinds of medications. People got through somehow. This is all a lot of hooey.
Some got through. Some didn't.
Mm.
Some were institutions back then. I mean, one thing people don't realize is that children used to be sent away for very long periods of time, for years. Even until the 1980s, they were sent away for months. And they were treated with medication then. They were treated with Thorazine, which was the only thing that there was, which is a terrible drug. I mean, can work wonders for people, but has terrible side effects. So, you know, the most severely affected kids were around, but were just not, you know, people didn't see them because they weren't in school with the mainstream kids until the mid-70s. Schools did not have to provide an education for kids who had really serious learning problems or serious emotional problems. They could be kept at home. So we didn't see it. The other thing is, for kids who had more mild problems, let's say, who had ADHD, suffered from depression or anxiety, you know, not to the point where they were sent to institutions, the parents of the kids today who have issues remember what it was like to be a kid with issues in the 50s or 60s. They remember being called dumb or lazy or weird. They remembered walking around sort of in a fog and not knowing what was wrong with them. They remember in the late 60s and 70s self-medicating with drugs, with alcohol. You know, I think that we can all look back also and remember kids who kind of just went off the rails, smart kids who seemed like they could have had a good start in life, who should have had a good life, but who somehow never got it together, maybe we're never able to move out of their parents' home. Maybe we're never able to, you know, go to college, kids who could have gone to college but just couldn't, or they couldn't finish, or things just didn't come together for them. There are a lot of people like that. And I think that today we consider that all children have the right to be able to try to live up to their potential. You know, and it's not a question of sort of remolding kids or saying it's unacceptable if you get B's. It's not that. But that kids can live up to their potential. And if there are roadblocks that they're living up to their potential and having the lives that they should naturally have following from their, you know, God-given abilities, if you will, that we're going to do something about that. We're not going to let them just fall by the wayside. And I think that that's a shift in attitude that's happened in recent decades, and which is a very good thing.
You trace, because you have to in this book to to flesh out the whole story, this anti-psychiatry movement and how and when it began. And also we need to talk about the negative activities of the pharmaceutical industry, which also fueled a lot of this questioning about over-medication because people were making money off it. Can you start with anti-psychiatry? Because that certainly is a large part of this.
I mean, psychiatry has always been the most poorly considered branch of medicine. As Thomas Insel, the head of the National Institute of Mental Health, put it to me, you know, the only specialty where the doctors are more stigmatized than the disease itself. So that has been true for a very long time. And certainly in the 1960s, as part of the general social rebellion of the time, was a rebellion against psychiatry, the perception of it as a discourse of power that needed to be overturned, a force of conformity, trying to fit people into boxes, medicating people into, you know, using kind of chemical lobotomies to control people. And, you know, there were plenty of good reasons to criticize psychiatry coming out of the post-war period. Freudianism, which is what had, you know, a hold over the profession for almost entirely from the 30s in America on through the 70s, was filled with sexist attitudes. When you look at some of the writing at the time, certainly some of the advertising of the time, very sexist, often racist. You know, there is a racist history there. And there were terrible treatments in that post-war period. Insulin shock, electroshock therapy used in a way that was really brutal and dangerous. And the psychiatric hospitals in that period were terrible places where people were warehoused, where they didn't get, you know, proper individualized care, where they were given, you know, powerful medications, sometimes over-medicated, where they were just sort of in there for years and years without hope. So, you know, there was a lot to rebel against in the late 60s, and that rebellion happened. But the problem is that many of us picked up our vision of psychiatry from a book or movie like One Flew Out of the Cuckoo's Nest, which is a product of that period, let's say, and kept that vision of psychiatry over all of these decades, when in fact the profession changed a great deal, where you have successive generations of psychiatrists who came out of the 60s themselves, let's say, or the years after, you know, who aren't steeped in all of the prejudices and biases of the past. And, you know, you have the practice which has changed enormously in terms of which medications they use, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, there's this kind of holdover, there's a kind of leftist holdover, which I certainly, a tradition I came out of in looking at psychiatry. There's also a right-wing bias against psychiatry, especially child psychiatry, the idea being that somehow parental responsibility is being usurped or parents are choosing not to live up to their responsibilities and that this kind of responsibility is being handed over to these doctors. And again, that there is a tinkering with people's souls, you know, where people aren't kind of taking responsibility for and being true to their authentic God-given souls. And, you know, in various forms, these strands run so strongly through our culture. Even all of the recent stories about how antidepressants don't work, people are being diagnosed with depression when there's nothing wrong with them. There is such a disconnect in these stories from what actually goes on with people who suffer from depression, such a lack of understanding of how real the problem is and how useful for some people some medications can be, and I mean, you have to qualify it in all kinds of different ways,
right,
that I think, again, we see these same forms of bias very much alive and well.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's true that you just have to have been there. You have to have seen it in your child or experienced it firsthand to realize that some of these drugs can keep you living.
That's right. And, you know, experience of having a child who suffers from mental health issues is one of those things that if you haven't experienced it, if you haven't seen it close hand, if you don't work with people like that, if you don't have close relatives dealing with it, you don't understand because it's beyond your realm of experience. And that's one of the key problems.
Right. And what about this idea of pharmaceutical companies pushing their products?
This is true. And the pharmaceutical companies have behaved horribly in many ways, sitting on negative results, only publishing results from drug trials that make their products look good, hiding information about very, very dangerous, sometimes deadly side effects, trying to encourage doctors to push off-label uses of drugs, extending the drug's reach, the commercial reach of these drugs, far beyond what they've been approved to do, giving us these direct-to-consumer ads that just really trivialize mental health conditions and present them as basically problems of everyday living in order to draw in more and more people to the drugs. All of this is a real problem. All of this has played an enormous role in eroding the public's trust then in psychiatry.
We have many people who want to speak with you and much to discuss with Judith Warner, our guest. Her book has just been released, We've Got Issues, Children and Parents in the Age of Medication. She is also the author of Perfect Madness, Motherhood in the Age of Anxiety, and Hillary Clinton, The Inside Story. She writes for the New York Times, and we're going to welcome phone calls for her. One line is open if you'd like to join us. 800-486-8655 is the number. The email address is talk@WPR.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Judith Warner, our guest this hour, author of We've Got Issues, Children and Parents in the Age of Medication. We start our calls with Lynn from Madison. Hi, Lynn.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I actually just have a comment. I am a person, a mother of two young boys, and I grew up in a household. I had an older and a younger brother, and they both had a lot of difficulties in school, had trouble finishing school, going to school at all. And my older brother was in drug treatment, and my younger brother was diagnosed at about age 10, 11 with bipolar and was in treatment and was on medication. And so I have strong feelings about this, raising two boys of my own, and seeing some similar stuff. I have a four-year-old who's supposed to start kindergarten next year, and I don't think he's ready. I think it's too much for him at this young age, and he's very physical and very similar to my younger brother who was diagnosed with bipolar. And I am just trying to stay extremely involved and on top of what's going on with him rather than turn to outside sources necessarily to sort of fix him and give him the extra time that he needs as well to sort of developmentally mature to be ready for kindergarten. And I definitely see how this kind of situation occurs in families with their kids not knowing what to do. And I definitely agree with what you guys are saying on the radio today. So I can leave my comments and be off there.
Thank you, Lynn. Judith.
I can understand why Lynn would want to take the time to really stay on top of this situation herself, especially since there is so much worry right now about bipolar disorder being overdiagnosed in children, especially young children. You know, this is the biggest area of controversy in child psychiatry right now. We've had this enormous 40-fold increase in bipolar diagnoses in children, with a lot of specialists who think that it's being overdiagnosed, that a lot of the kids who are being brought under that umbrella really don't belong there. And the big problem with it is that the medications that are used to treat bipolar disorder are so powerful, they can be dangerous. And, you know, if there are other options, it's so much better to be able to avoid them. And there's a lot of interesting thinking going on right now to try to come up with other ways to look at these kids and try to have a much more accurate sense of what's going on with them, a different viewpoint that can actually open up different avenues to treatment that don't have to involve these drugs.
Thanks very much for the call. We go to Jenny next from Green Bay. Hi, Jenny.
Hello. I just wanted to make a comment earlier, and I sympathize with Lynn because I've been there. I have two boys who have been medicated for several years for ADHD. Initially, you know, you go in with that stereotype in your head that people are thinking you're the lazy parent and you're medicating your child because you're just too lazy to parent correctly. But then it quickly turns to, you know, you're trying so hard to do everything right that all of a sudden you're the helicopter parent, and you end up, you know, in a situation you just really can't win.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard because you do need to stay on top of your kids when you're not just everything. You know, you have constant doctor appointments, constant meetings with teachers. And we're paying $200 a copay just for two medications a month for the boys.
Hmm.
And
how are they doing, Jenny?
Actually, they struggle, but are doing well. I know my oldest son, if he wasn't medicated, would probably be in the legal system right now. I'm sure of it. His doctor is sure of it. But he's not, and he's doing well. but he has a hard time, you know, controlling himself sometimes. But it's just, you know, it feels like you're in a no-win situation.
Right.
So it's, I'm almost crying listening to her talk because it's so, it really is so personal. And I just hope Lynn sticks with it and everybody else out there just does what they have to do for the kids, because this is a hard thing to deal with.
Judith.
That's it. Yes. That's all I have to say. Thanks.
Thank you.
I'm just struck over and over again by how parents just struggle to do the right things for their children. And they have to, again, follow their gut. They have to know what's right and what works. And they have to tune out so many negative messages that are coming at them that are aimed at making them feel guilty that they're doing the wrong thing. And, of course, parents beat themselves up so much. You know, they beat themselves up for trying medication. And then I hear them beating themselves up once their children are doing better with medication for not having tried it sooner.
Right.
And they blame them for that, so themselves for that. So I think it's just so hard to keep remembering that what you're doing is looking out for your children and doing your absolute best for them. And there's a lot of stuff, background noise, that just has to be tuned out.
Here is a different perspective, an email from Jesse. We're absolutely giving our children too many drugs. I believe that they can be a viable solution in some cases, but some doctors seem all too willing to prescribe drugs for hyper-overactive children. They are children. They're supposed to be hyper. I do put most of the blame, however, on parents who are perhaps too tired or burned out from work to deal with a child when they come home. Chemical solutions are not the answer.
Here's what people don't realize. First of all, that there aren't that many children who are taking psychotropic medication. 5% of kids take these medications. 5 to 20% of kids are believed to have mental health issues, the 5% being those with really serious ones, the 20% being those with milder ones or with learning disabilities. And there's a misperception, too, about what ADHD is. ADHD isn't just about hyperactivity or about, you know, high-spirited. I mean, it isn't at all about high-spirited children. It's not, and it's not uniquely about hyperactivity. It's about a whole range of cognitive, behavioral, emotional learning issues that have to do largely with self-regulation, that also have to do with inattention, and all kinds of different cognitive processes, working memory, all sorts of things that go far beyond just the issue of hyperactivity and overactivity. I mean, there are some kids who are just really, really active. But, you know, it isn't just because a kid is very high energy that he or she, but when we're talking about hyperactivity, it's usually a boy, ends up in a doctor's office. It's because something is going wrong in that child's life. The child maybe is very unhappy with the feedback that he or she is getting from other people and is getting a really negative sense of him or herself. Or there is some real level of impairment. The child isn't able to live his or her life normally. That's what brings these kids into treatment. It isn't that parents are kind of worn out at the end of the day and sick of them.
Let's go next to a caller from Appleton. What is your name?
My name is Gib.
Gib. Hi, Gib.
Hi. Thank you very much for having me on your program.
Sure.
I'll try to keep it brief. There's so much I'd like to say. But I've been a clinical social worker for 35 years, so I've been able to kind of watch the evolution of mental health care. I've seen people wonderfully helped by compassionate care, prescribing medicines. But I also am someone who's done biofeedback kind of work for that length of time. And there's an emerging scientific base that is struggling to kind of emerge against some biases that I think are in the system in terms of reimbursement and research. But self-regulation is something I heard you mention, and there's an emerging evidence base that people can learn to self-regulate very significantly brain function through exercise, diet, and even feedback of the EEG of the brain. And I'd like to hear comments from the author and take those off the air, please.
Thank you, Gib, for your call.
I've heard a lot of interesting things about biofeedback, and, you know, it certainly seems like a very promising field. You know, the problem with a lot of the treatments that aren't yet considered mainstream is that they're enormously expensive, and health insurance doesn't reimburse them. So, you know, right now, they're things that are available for wealthy kids. And, you know, in my research, wealthy kids have access to just everything.
there is no limit to the different treatments the parents can try, the different ways they can try to avoid medication, you know, the therapies they can get, alternative and mainstream. And they can, the parents can accomplish a great deal. Now, if you're a middle-class person and you're just trying to deal within the constraints of your health insurance, you're facing a completely different landscape, mm-hmm. and it is just heartbreaking.
It sure is, and that in order for children to be healthier and for there to be some equity here, you do write in the book how we need to examine that history to make sure that mental health is available if we ever get any kind of health care reform for everybody.
That's right. And I mean, that won't solve debates over, you know, is biofeedback scientifically validated or not. But there needs to be more studies of alternatives. I know there are studies of alternatives done at the NIH, and there needs to be more of that. And we need government studies. You know, we need studies that aren't funded by people who have entrenched interest in the outcome.
Thanks for the call. We go next to Mary Ellen from Madison. Hi, Mary Ellen.
Hi, how are you today?
Fine, how are you?
Great.
Good.
Thanks so much for having me on the call. I've got a bit of a different perspective because I'll take it to from youth to teenagers. Now, I didn't have any, I raised three sons and didn't have to medicate my children. But what I saw when my sons moved into high school was the volume of medication being passed around by youth because the youth who had been medicated were selling their drugs. And I just wonder about the recourse to our teenagers, the impact that it's having to our teenagers today because of the pharmaceutical companies actually over-medicating the youth that shouldn't be medicated. I truly believe that there are some that need to be medicated. But what are your thoughts about the impact to the teenagers and then post-teenagers?
I think that this whole issue of kids selling their medication and kids who don't need medication taking it in order to stay up all night and they think up their performance on tests is a really serious problem that needs to be addressed in a much more kind of concerted way. Because this is drug abuse. I mean, and it's really important not to mix the two stories together. You know, use of prescription medication by kids for whom it's prescribed by a doctor is one thing. Use of prescription meds by kids who don't need them and who are just trying to up their performance. You know, it's like athletes taking steroids to compete better, except that I think the effect is less dramatic. I mean, the drugs will help you stay up all night, but they're not going to make you actually perform any better. They're not going to make you any smarter or any better organized in your thinking if you don't actually have ADHD in the first place. And, you know, parents need to be more on top of this, clearly, because if the kids are selling their drugs, they're not taking them themselves. And it shouldn't be possible for them to take their pills into school and sell them. Now, on college campuses, of course, it's that much harder because the parents aren't there. But if this is happening in high school, it means the parents aren't paying close enough attention, I think. And once again, it's very serious. It needs to be stopped. But we shouldn't merge these two stories together and think that what's happening in the realm of drug abuse reflect on what's going on in mainstream psychiatry when children are getting appropriate care.
Mm-hmm. Interesting points. Thanks, Mary Ellen. I want to go back to what you were saying earlier because it ties in somewhat to earlier work that you've done. What about this? You talked about our children's problems, metaphors for our age. What about our age? How does that factor into this?
I think it factors in a couple of ways. I think that the competitiveness of our age, the anxious helicopter parenting, the sort of gross behavior generally of a lot of parents, and the increasingly distasteful behavior, I think, of a lot of teens in terms of things like cheating, in terms of just having that kind of narrow focus on achievement at all costs. All of this primes us to think the worst of parents and kids, so that then if we hear that kids are getting diagnosed with various issues and getting all these different treatments, it's like we're just ready to think that this has to do with this other social phenomenon, that parents must be trying to get their kids a leg up, and that all this medication use has to be about boosting performance. Again, the way drugs are used, steroids are used in sports. And, you know, that's it's a mistake that's easy to understand given the context of what's going on. But again, it's a mistake. It's a conflation of two stories that really aren't related.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, we can look at our society and say, are there aspects about the way we live today that make things worse for kids, that potentiate problems in kids who would have them, or create other kinds of problems that aren't necessarily mental health issues in children who don't have mental health issues? And I think we can say that there are problems, that, you know, the stress that's rampant in our society is toxic for kids. It doesn't, in and of itself, in sort of normal doses, you know, not in cases of abuse or neglect, single-handedly cause mental illness, but certainly makes life worse for everyone.
Karen from Fort Atkinson is next. Hi, Karen.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's so interesting. We've come such a long way, and then in some cases, we've come nowhere at all. My mother committed suicide when I was 15, and she had clinical depression. I'm in my 50s now, and she was helped by her MD by giving her ups in the morning and downers to put her to sleep at night. And back then, if you were to even mention going to a psychiatrist, it was so taboo. And it meant you were a bad, unhealthy, mentally incapable person. So now we don't have as much of a stigma anymore, and that has come and changed, and a lot of people are getting the help. But then we go back to the insurance companies and what they're doing to those people who need the help, and they can't afford the medications to get the help. And it just is so unfortunate the way this keeps going round and round. But back to that one caller who talked about other avenues to assist with clinical depression, there's a book out there I was just reading, Walking Your Blues Away, and it talks about bilateral therapies. And I was wondering if you could speak to that at all.
I'm not familiar with that specifically, but I mean, there are forms of psychotherapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, which has been proven to have great effects on depression and anxiety. These things are individual decisions, and I'm not a doctor. You know, I can't kind of recommend treatment plans. But what you say is very true. We have made all of this progress, and at the same time, there are continued roadblocks to progress. I mean, I believe stigma is alive and well. And it just takes the form now of our saying, well, parents are just stuffing their kids full of drugs. That's the new face of mental health stigma when it comes to kids. And people are not able to access good treatments beyond medication, getting therapy, very, very expensive. Half of all mental health practitioners don't participate in health insurance.
Oh, my.
You know, there is so much that can be done for people today. So much progress has been made. But if people don't have access to quality care, then what good is it?
Right. And let's talk about those medications. You talk about the medications that can help people today. Many of these are relatively new advancements. Is it hard still to figure out what works for people and what doesn't work? Is it still rather inexact, or are doctors becoming right on with medications that will work for bipolar or ADHD?
Well, unfortunately, it's still largely trial and error. They try something, they see if it works or not, then they have to try something else if it doesn't. I mean, with children specifically, they're growing and changing all the time, so, you know, doses have to be changed and things have to be tweaked. And, you know, when they have hormonal changes coming into it, then that poses additional problems, too. It is not an exact science.
Thanks for your call, Karen. We go to Shelley from Madison. Hello.
Hi, I just had a question, and then I'll just take my answer off the air. Over the years, I've worked in a lot of special ed departments and noticed that a lot of, it seems like it's more prevalent in boys than girls, and it's interesting, too, because all the callers so far have called talking about their boys, and I guess I'm, you know, been wondering about this a lot lately because I'm pregnant now with a boy, and I'm, you know, immediately when I found out, that's what I thought, like, oh, the incidence seems like it's so much higher with, you know, boys versus girls. And I was wondering if she found that to be true and if she found anything about why that would be the case. And I'll just take my answer off the air.
Okay.
Well, the incidence of autism is, you know, considerably higher in boys. there's a feeling that with ADHD, it's boys who get diagnosed because they tend to have the form of the disorder that affects their behavior, and so it gets noticed, and that girls tend to have the inattentive form of ADHD and pass under the radar. You know, they're staring out the window. They're not having impulse control problems and disrupting the class. So there's a feeling that girls very often are underdiagnosed, and that's why you see so many more boys.
Do you think, though, that Shelley should even be worrying about this right now? After all, she's just pregnant. You don't want to put the whole pile of worries on you right now, do you?
No, and I also, I mean, and this is something I wrote about a lot in my Times column. I think that the whole boy crisis thing, boys are being pathologized, boys are being overdiagnosed, is something of a red herring. I mean, you know, there's so much worry about the state of boys right now because they're apparently falling behind girls. And, you know, these things are being presented as some kind of zero-sum game. If girls are up, boys must be down. And the truth is that when you look carefully at the statistics, poor boys, minority boys, are struggling and are doing badly. White upper-middle-class boys are doing just as well as ever, if not better. So, you know, I think that problems that have to do with race and class are being turned into a kind of gender argument, and I find the whole thing suspect. So all of that just to say, there's no particular reason why you should have to worry about your son.
Right. Well, there's the next book.
It's been done already.
Not quite that way. You know, the idea of upper-middle-class boys are doing just fine, I don't think that's what most people are thinking these days.
No, they're not thinking that.
Yeah. Let's go to Gretchen from Waukesha. Hi, Gretchen.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to thank your guest, Judy, for raising the awareness for parents that have normal children to let them know that when parents do have a child with significant mental health issues that we're not exaggerating, we're not throwing a big pity party for ourselves in order to have more attention paid to our child. I have a 7-year-old with significant mental health problems and have spent close to 3 years trying to find what will help him. And a lot of my peers don't seem to understand that when you have a child like this, you really need to be diligent in finding that help.
Have you found it?
Yes. Yes, finally, this past year, we have gotten a lot of good answers for his problems and been pointed in a good direction to help him.
Good.
I always think of it as an odyssey, what parents go through. You know, when I would talk to parents, they would tell me, they would always start by telling me a story, you know, and it would be a story that would begin very early in the child's life and would be a story of confusion, seeing confusing signs, behaviors, things, and not quite knowing what was wrong, and then going to the pediatrician, and very often the pediatrician saying, oh, well, you're just worrying about nothing, or, you know, a back and forth, different people, different diagnoses, different treatments that did or didn't work, and it was never simple, and it was often so long and convoluted. But, you know, what you just said about the difficulty in being understood by people who don't have children with these issues, just this past weekend, as I was finishing a book tour, a friend told me something that I found so painful to hear. She has a son who has Asperger's and ADHD, and our children were in preschool together. And she remembers my sitting in her kitchen and saying to her, he's fine. There's nothing wrong with him. You know, people are just always trying to find fault with these kids. He's just fine. And when she told me that, I mean, I had tears in my eyes. I felt so terrible for having delegitimized her experience in that way. And yet, I thought I was doing the right thing. I thought that I was helping and supporting her and, you know, trying to be a supportive friend.
Thank you so much, Gretchen, for your call. More phone calls momentarily. Judith Warner is our guest, author of We've Got Issues, Children and Parents in the Age of Medication. A couple lines are open now. 800-486-8655 is our number, and the email address talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Children and Parents in the Age of Medication, We've Got Issues is the title of Judith's book, Judith Warner, and we are going to take a quick email here, Judith, from Andy on Facebook, who says, duh, we're taking too many drugs ourselves.
Yeah, I know. That's the perception. I mean, that's the feeling, that we're a drugged-up country. I don't know. Maybe we are, but is it just psychiatric medications? We take medications for all sorts of things. It's so easy to generalize, but, you know, when you actually get talking to people about what the medications do for them and what the effect is on their lives, it becomes really, really hard to make these sweeping statements about how we're taking too many meds.
Meredith from Illinois. Hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking me on.
Sure.
I just heard this and I had to call in. I have been on medication since I was 14, and actually I've had really, really bad anxiety since I was 7. And I would just like to say, like, look, I didn't want to go on medications, but they've probably saved my life. And they've made me able to function, just be able to get up in the morning. And you might say that I'm one of the people who have, like, those, oh, definitely she should be on meds. So I, like, get that escape clause from people's argument. But I'd say one of the most difficult things is to mention that you're on meds or something and have that look in your people's eyes, like, oh. And then people have told me, oh, I don't believe in, you know, bipolar disorder. I don't believe in depression. And it's, you know, if you don't believe in it, please try it out for a week and then come back and talk to me.
Right. Right.
And I'll trade places if you want.
Right.
So anyway, I'd just like to say that people out there who are criticizing parents for their choices, they don't know what it's like to live with it. They don't know what it's like to see your child come home crying every day. And they should please think twice before you tell someone else how to parent their children, especially very, very loving parents.
Well, I couldn't agree more. I mean, it's one of those walk a mile in another man's shoes kinds of situations. And, you know, to be generous with people, you know, I think some of it at base is nothing more than just a lack of understanding. But sometimes I think there is something insidious about it. I think there is something kind of malicious about it. And I think it just comes down so much to the fact that we disdain parents right now. And there's frankly just so much hostility floating around the culture right now, especially on the internet.
Yeah, I mean, that's crazy. It is, I'm with you. So almost all parents I know, every parent I know, tries to do a good job of this. It is not an easy thing to do. It's just, it is just, you know this as a mom, it's just really hard to be a parent. It's a big thing.
It is, and it's very easy to be a scold.
Yes, exactly, about everything in life, right?
Yes, it is. And I mean, I have moved away from some of my earlier work because it became more and more difficult to just be a scold. And you realize you're just in bad faith.
Let's go. Thanks, Meredith, so much for your call. Let's go next to Maddie from Waupaca. Hello.
Hi. I really want to encourage parents to have their children's vitamin D levels checked. I was diagnosed with major clinical depression, and the medications helped me, but not as not totally what put me over the top.
I'm not sure. Tell me what you know about vitamin D. We talked to a lot of doctors for this. Are there vitamins that are encouraged, or is that too simple?
There are doctors who recommend fish oil specifically. That's something that's being studied by the NIMH to see if fish oil can make a difference with depression, with ADHD. I mean, I don't think the definitive results have come out yet, but there are a lot of doctors who do recommend that. I'm not familiar with the discussion of vitamin D, but, I mean, that doesn't mean that it's not happening and isn't valid.
Right. I know that there's controversy concerning heart and vitamin D, but that'll be settled at some point. I want to go back to these statistics for a moment, Judith, because something has to change for there to be any change in the lives of children and their being able to complete their lives in a healthy fashion. There are only, you write, 7,000 child psychiatrists currently practicing in this country, and they are overwhelmingly concentrated in the big cities. So we've got rural areas where there are no child psychiatrists and no psychologists, and in the big cities, even long waiting lists. Now, how's anybody going to get better given that?
That's absolutely right. I mean, the lack of access is a huge, huge problem. The residency programs in child psychiatry in our country are not even being filled up. You know, this is a profession that, for so many reasons, is just not appealing. As medical specialties go, it's not that highly paid. It is looked down on. There needs to be some way to create incentives for more young doctors to to go into this. And a lot of it also really is going to have to do with the insurance situation. Insurance reimbursing better mental health care, and also at a certain point, doctors being willing to participate in insurance and potentially earn somewhat less money, at least for a certain number of patients. Because given that there is such a shortage of child psychiatrists and child psychologists, it's very easy for them not to have to take insurance because they will find enough patients. But, you know, you've got these whole populations that are being left behind, and something there really has to change.
Right. Thanks, Maddie, for your call. Jane from Fort McCoy. Hi, Jane.
Good morning.
Hi.
See, I have kind of a positive, great story, but I'll be quick with it. But I do want to reflect on one part of it. I have a sister who I know is depressed, and luckily she's come through quite a bit. And she was a single parent, had a child at 32, when she was 32 years old. He was diagnosed with ADD when he was in kindergarten. She refused to let them persuade her to put him on medication. She just kind of stuck with him. Well, then at about 11 years old, he made that choice with her and said, "Mom, let me just try it to see if it helps me focus." So he had his hand in the decision, which was really cool because right now he's not on it during this school year, but he was last year, and he's doing better this year. So during the summer, he wasn't on any kind of medication. She's on a lot of medication. But my question or my statement or what I want you to reflect on is she was depressed, slept a lot, you know, and here she was raising this young, beautiful baby boy, and I'm sure it has that environmental situation has to have some effect on ADD or depression as well.
Judith.
You know, I think there's really interesting research suggesting, actually, that maternal depression can have a real effect on the child in the womb, even. And there's no doubt that maternal depression is a toxin for children. Whether it causes ADHD, you know, I think is something that seems pretty tenuous given the nature of ADHD. However, could it cause forms of distress that lead to behaviors that look like ADHD and maybe aren't really? I'm sure there are plenty of doctors who could make that argument, and that's why it's so important that children really get comprehensive evaluations when the time comes before they start any kind of medication or any kind of treatment at all, any kind of therapy, whatever else. Real evaluations that rule out, that look at a child's life in its entirety, rule out physical health problems, look at possible causes of stress or anxiety in a child's life, you know, that get a sort of emotional picture of the child as well as kind of how they're functioning in school and get information from a lot of different sources. It's expensive to do this. I mean, it costs a couple $1,000s. School systems are supposed to provide these kind of evaluations, but that only happens when a child sort of meets a certain threshold of dysfunction, which a lot of them don't, and there are always all kinds of roadblocks thrown up for that. So, you know, maybe I think your question makes sense, and I think what it comes down to is, did the child really have ADHD or not?
Thanks for the call. Paula from Janesville, hi.
Yeah, hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Paula.
You know, no matter how I think what I wanted to say, it's too long. It's not a very palatable subject, but I was a child like you're talking about. I come from a home, however, of an alcoholic custodial mother, and that was a lot of stress for me to grow up in.
Hmm.
And that has been an issue in our country for years. People drink and they minimize the effects on other people's lives, children to start with. And that needs to be looked at, I believe, as a culprit.
Mm-hmm. Judith.
Yes, I mean, in terms of the stress that it puts on children, sometimes trauma for children, but also in terms of what's going on with the parent who's drinking. There was a woman who I interviewed whose son has terrible anxiety problems. And she feels that her mother, who was an alcoholic, was self-medicating against anxiety all those years.
Mm-hmm.
And that the anxiety got passed down through her to her son. And, you know, so it isn't only an environmental influence. often there's some genetic influence going on there as well. And I think, you know, I think thinking about that also conceivably gives us more compassion for people and what they're going through and what drives some of their behaviors.
Yeah, I guess that some of what we're taking from all of this is we need to be more compassionate people, right, Judith?
I think we really do. Mm-hmm. I think that it's so easy not to be, again, as you were saying earlier, and to just pass judgment, especially on parents.
Yes.
And we lose sight, again, of the reality of the pain that drives so much of
exactly.
what people do and how they act.
Thank you so much for writing the book and for being with us.
Oh, well, thank you so much for this great discussion.
Judith Warner, the book is We've Got Issues, Children and Parents in the Age of Medication. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We'll be with you again tomorrow. Great conversations ahead, so stay with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.